Blog Talk Radio.
This is for you, Kings fans, wherever you may be. All the frustration and disappointment of the past is gone.
If you're still awake, it is 11:31 on April 27th, and there is only one California team left in the NHL playoffs. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the JewelCast. It may be your second listen of the day. If it is, you are really dedicated, and I'm impressed. And if not, then later you'll have to catch up after Nick and Derek spent the afternoon making fun of various Kings players and various Ducks players, and turns out they were justified. So I actually almost went to the Clippers game this evening because apparently I hadn't had enough of watching a Los Angeles team with promising playoff hopes get decimated by injury. So I thought about it, and instead I came home and I watched as the Nashville Predators eliminated the Anaheim Ducks in Game 7. We are waiting for Jake from Fear the Finn. Looks like he is just calling in now. So let me put him on the air.
Oh, I was muted
Jake,
before.
Can
wow,
you hear me?
That's good. All that inflammatory stuff I said before, that didn't make it. Great. Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. My improv intro lasted exactly as long as it took for you to join in, so... that worked out beautifully.
Wow, great timing. Yeah, we choreographed that beautifully, just like we drew it up.
Yeah, we planned this all out really well. So, thanks for checking in. Did you get to catch the game tonight?
I did. Watched the whole thing even. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I thought it was a fun game. I enjoyed it.
It's been sort of a rule of thumb that every time I turn my attention to rooting for the Ducks, things don't go very well, and I was surprised at the number of Kings fans that were just openly, absolutely rooting against the Ducks today, because I think from my perspective, as an eliminated team, I'm looking for entertaining matchups more than anything, and especially when it comes to the first round, I'm not necessarily looking for rivals to get eliminated that early, especially when it sets the stage for something like Ducks-Sharks. However, you're looking for the better matchup. So are you pleased with the way things went down?
Absolutely. I mean, I figured, you know, I know that there are definitely Sharks fans that, you know, I assume through some, you know, weird way of exercising their own demons, wanted the Ducks in the second round. But, I mean, if you just look at the numbers, you know, I mean, it's just the Predators are just not as good a team as Anaheim is. And that's, I mean, I really don't feel like that's even that controversial a statement. You know, that's a better matchup, but I'm happy about it. And, you know, listen, getting the Ducks eliminated in the process, that's just icing on the cake.
And it was interesting to watch it all unfold because as the Ducks crew of Ehlers and Hayward hilariously mentioned after the game, it was a different Game 7 loss than usual, which isn't going to be of much consolation to most Ducks fans, but it was competitive. It was, for once it felt like the Ducks sort of deserved to be in it at the end. And they got one goal in the third period, about a minute 45 in, I think it was. And from then on, Pekka Rinne, who has really not been up to his usual standards this season, decided to
show he's been bad this year. Yeah, he has not been good. Honestly, though, isn't this game just a microcosm for what the Ducks did this season? You know, they screwed themselves early, let the other team take over the game, and they decided, like, oh, hey, let's show up and let's actually play hockey, right? And that's what they did this season, and it, you know, worked out as far as winning the division. But, you know, it's just one of those things where it's like, you know, it, even if you play, you know, well enough to win, you know, if you go out of your way to take away some of the bullets you have in the chamber, you know, you're not gonna, you're relying on winning too many coin flips. And I think that's really what the Ducks' problem was this whole series. It all starts because they just didn't really play that well in the first two games, you know, and guess what?
Yeah.
Now, you know, did they outplay the Predators overall? I think probably, but you know, you shot yourselves in the foot so early that now you put your hands and, you know, put your fate into Luck's hands. And that's, as a Sharks fan, I can tell you, is not a whole lot of fun.
And the decision I think everyone's going to go back to is the decision to start John Gibson in games 1 and 2. And
right.
For the Ducks, it so often seems like they just can't find that goalie to take them through the playoffs. And I don't know how many people were second-guessing that decision 2 weeks ago. I'd have to ask a Ducks fan or 12. But, you know, Gibson was an all-star this year. He certainly played well for large chunks of the season, but Frederik Andersen had, and goalie wins and losses aren't everything, but Andersen won a lot of games this year. He was good early on, even when the Ducks weren't, as far as I remember. And when the Ducks started winning, he was in goal for most of those wins. So it's a fascinating decision. It's one that they're going to be talking about the entire offseason, and it certainly made a huge difference because Gibson laid an egg in games 1 and 2.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you look, and I had looked this up previously, look at all the games Ducks played this year, you know, including the playoffs. Frederik Andersen played 48 games and had an even strength save percentage of 930. John Gibson played 42 games, had an even strength save percentage of 919. That's not close. Hmm. That it's just not, you know, that should not be a tough decision. So I don't really know what the thinking was there. I don't even know necessarily if that's the reason that they lost the series, but you know, it's like I always say, it's like, you know, when people ask, you know, oh, why do you always harp on, you know, who's being played on the third line or the fourth line? Those guys aren't going to cost you the series, that kind of a thing. It's like, well, that's probably true. But you know, if you're talking about a series where there, you only have a, you know, 49 or 51% chance of winning, then, you know, listen, everything matters, you know, giving yourself, you know, any edge you can is how you, you know, win in the playoffs. So I think that's a mistake. I don't really know what the logic was behind it because I quite frankly just don't follow the Ducks all that closely, especially with, you know, so much other stuff going on or whatever. But yeah, that seems like a mistake to me.
Right. And some quick research. Andersen, I think, had a – not I think – I'm seeing Andersen had a 917 overall save percentage this year, which is not spectacular.
It's not great. It's
slightly below both Jones and Quick, who were at 918. Although Quick got him by a couple hundredths of the save percentage, so take that. But the Andersen did have a concussion coming down the stretch. I wonder how much that played into Bruce Boudreau's decision. But Andersen did get a couple starts at the end of the season. He was concussed. Andersen was concussed on March 30th, came back for the, I think, the final game of the season. So Andersen was great in this series, and it's not his fault the Ducks lost Game 7. It's not his fault the Ducks lost in the first round. But, again, like you said, it's sort of a microcosm where the series started out badly, the game started out badly, the entire season started out badly, and the recovery was pretty impressive, but it just wasn't enough.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, really the takeaway, at least, you know, if I was a Ducks fan or trying to talk to a Ducks fan tonight, would be that, you know, like what they showed over the last, you know, whatever, half of the season, that's the team that at least I thought, you know, they were going to be the whole year. You know, I picked them to win the division this year, which I've, you know, I thought that they would, the difference I thought between this team and previous teams, that this team was actually really good and not just really lucky like they've been in the past. So
sure.
I you know, I don't know. It's a weird team where I don't know, like, what really the problem is as far as, you know, them not scoring so much early or whatever. Maybe it's just bad luck. But I think, honestly, the biggest concern, if I'm a Ducks fan tonight, is that management overreacts. That is the absolute worst thing that could happen to Anaheim, and the best thing that could happen to both of us, because a bad Anaheim team next year would be really good news for the Sharks and the Kings.
100%. And the Ducks, you know, down the stretch, they made some smart moves, moves that maybe were questioned at the time. I think getting David Perron, and I'm remembering now that John Rosen, LA Kings insider, tweeted back in February when Perron was being a thorn on the Kings' side that he's a noted non-performer in the playoffs. And I think he had 3 points in 7 games. Garba played really well for them over stretches. He still fits in with some of the dirtier players on Anaheim, but he was much more of a factor than a lot of people expected. So the Ducks, they're not facing, I think, any sort of crisis unless, like you said, they bring it upon themselves. And the one guy who's going to be more fearing for his job than anybody else is Boudreau. And we published an article earlier today talking about Daryl Sutter and whether he's the right man for the job over the next couple of years. I don't think that anybody is calling for Sutter to get fired, but it brought up the really interesting hypothetical of would you take Bruce Boudreau over Daryl Sutter at this point? And I'm curious what you think.
No, probably not. I guess the question is if, you know, Peter DeBoer, you know, gets fired tomorrow, which do I prefer? Yeah, probably Bruce Boudreau. but if I'm a Kings fan, just, I don't know, the familiarity with the group, I think that probably counts for something. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's hard to say. I guess if I'm a Kings fan that just watched my team lose to my biggest rival in 5 games, maybe I'm thinking, oh, maybe we need a different voice or whatever, and I can understand that. But I really don't think you can go wrong with either of those guys. That's a pretty terrible non-answer. I guess I'm just going to pick. If I'm a Kings fan, Daryl Sutter. For me personally, to coach the Sharks, Bruce Boudreau.
And I don't think
because
I like
the style of play Boudreau plays a lot better. So,
yeah. Ooh. Yeah. And Boudreau, other than his sort of quick trigger finger on the goalies, a lot of people, the general consensus was 20 teams would happily pick him up tomorrow over their current head coach. And Sutter's not going anywhere unless he decides, not to come back, although his contract is expiring this season. We had 57% of the readers say that the Kings should stick with Daryl Sutter.
Wow, only 57%?
Yeah, and 34.
Winning 2 cups doesn't get you a lot of loyalty these days, fam.
Well,
yeesh.
I think it's
brutal.
I think it's a symptom of the Kings sticking with players for longer than they should. And maybe it's...
Right, that's Dean Lombardi, though. Right?
Sure it is. But we've watched players decline in ability, and maybe there's sort of a feeling that the coach, you can get too loyal. And it's very different for players and coaches. And I also think that coaches' roles can get very overblown in these types of things. Bruce Boudreau didn't lose the series. And Daryl Sutter, you know, he absolutely turned the Kings around in 2012, but Quick was sensational the entire way through. You can't just say a coach won or lost the Stanley Cup. Having said that, Sutter was absolutely the right coach for that winter of 2011-12. Right now, is he the right coach? I maybe he's not the first choice that I would take in the entire NHL, but I have a hard time seeing him leave before he wants to.
Yeah, I think the thing is to me is that I look at it the same way that I look at like an NBA coach. A bad coach will hurt you a lot more than a good coach will help you. And maybe a great coach can make a difference. And I think in the NHL, like the list of great coaches it's short. It is small. I mean, you know, I think Daryl Sutter is probably one of the best 5 coaches in the NHL. And he still makes decisions that I think are just like clearly stupid and wrong. But that's not necessarily – I'm not trying to, you know, bag on Daryl Sutter. It's just that that's the way it is. That's our lot in, you know, NHL coaches in 2016. So, you know, to me, like, you know, even when last year, you know, when the Sharks, you know, quote unquote parted ways with Todd McClellan. It's like, well, okay, that's fine, I guess. But to me, the decision is who are we going to get next? Because if we're not replacing the current coach with someone who's at least as good, if not better, then it's a mistake. And firing a coach, I know, is a trendy thing to do sometimes because you're frustrated with the performance and playoffs and whatever. But I think that can, you know, cause you a lot more problems than it'll solve.
Yeah, and the Sharks replaced their coach who couldn't get to a Stanley Cup final with a guy who had been to a Stanley Cup final, albeit with a weaker team. And I don't – well, I'll ask you, what was the response when DeBoer replaced McClellan? Was it overwhelmingly positive? Was it a, well, maybe it's time for a change, or was it a bit negative?
Yeah, it was definitely, if I were to use one word to describe the general reaction, it'd be like, you know, meh. It's like, eh. If you look at his track record, he coached a New Jersey Devils team that, good Lord, may have been the literally most boring team to ever play in the NHL. That's not a guy you're going to get excited about. I thought that it was – I personally thought, you know, it was fine, whatever. Because, like I said, I don't really think the coach is all that important going forward. And I thought the Sharks had problems that were more roster-related than, coaching-related. So it was – but, yeah, I mean, I would even say that, you know, the response was, you know, from moderately whatever to, you know, a little bit negative. But I think part of that, too it's like now, like, Kings fans are thinking maybe we need a new coach because they just lost in five games. Well, Sharks fans were thinking that, you know, everything was horrible forever because, well, everything has been pretty horrible for quite a long time. So, you know, that's just – it's more a reflection of the fan base's general demeanor, I think, than it is an accurate reflection of what people would have thought in a, you know, neutral circumstance or whatever. So,
yeah.
I think it would be great if Boudreau goes to a team outside the Pacific. That would be fabulous. I would be perfectly happy with that. And then the Ducks should bring back Randy Carlyle. Thoughts?
I agree with that, too. I think he's won a cup there. I think he's the
mm-hmm.
– sorry.
He can get through to the players.
I'm lasting that long. It was a different NHL, and that's as far as I'm going to go. But sort of unrelated, I went back and watched one of those montages of all the overtime goals from the 2012 playoffs because I'm a Kings fan and sometimes I just have to live in the past. And I forgot I forgot how close New Jersey was to not even making it out of the first round. They were up against Florida. Florida was the number three seed, the division winner that everybody thought was, you know, your classic underperforming team that won a division, got home ice advantage somehow. And New Jersey had to win in overtime in game 6 and 7 to even beat that underwhelming Florida team. And of course, then they managed to go on. And I don't even remember who they took out in the second round, but then they beat New York in 6 games. New York, who, as we saw this year, was still in sort of that mold of, we're really good in the regular season and we win a lot of games, but that's because we have Henrik Lundqvist.
Yep.
So it's hard to bank on playoff success when you hire your head coach, and that's the maybe Bruce Boudreau is the only person who can prove it in the other direction. But you have to look at what he's going to bring your team, and Mike Babcock, obviously, I don't think any Toronto fan is too upset with that hire, even though he hasn't cracked the playoffs yet.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I think it's that's one of the things that fans like to overreact about a little bit, you know, but whatever. I don't really see most people, you know, unironically saying that they think Bruce Boudreau can't, you know, take a team past a game 7 or can't win in the playoffs. And, you know, I think if people think that, then, you know, I mean, I don't know. Everyone's welcome to be an idiot. It's not my place to tell people not to be stupid. Go crazy.
On that note, I like where you stand, and we're going to go and talk about the Sharks now because we've somehow managed to burn 20 minutes on the Ducks and on
God,
the coaching.
God, is this a Ducks podcast? Yeah, this is the worst.
Hey, we went Daryl Sutter, too. Sorry.
Yeah, you're right.
So I defend our programming choices. So
yeah, sorry. Ooh, sensitive topic.
Yeah, anyway. Sharks, they're on to round 2. They get Nashville. The consensus, I think, is going to be that the Sharks are clear favorites here. And is there anything that's giving
the Predators
pause about
have
Nashville?
Us right where they want us? Well, the Sharks are favorites. That's a bad sign.
There you go.
Historically speaking. No, I mean, yeah, I think the biggest concern has to be that Pekka could, like, wake up from this coma he's been in and suddenly be really good again. That would suck. Yeah, I think that's probably the biggest concern. Other than that, I mean, you know, there's just not a whole lot about Nashville that I find particularly scary. I think they went 1-2 against the Predators in the regular season, which I don't put a whole lot of stock in as a general rule anyway. Those two losses were both one goal games. To me, the difference in this series is if the officials call things the way they called them in that Sharks King series, for instance, which was pretty tight, I think we could probably both agree for the most part. Certainly tighter than playoffs previous to this year. That would be, I think, a pretty fair statement. Then I think the Sharks have to be favorites because the Predators are just, good Lord. I mean, they practically made Anaheim look disciplined in these last five games. It's just, they just take too many penalties. They just do. And I think, you know, I mean, the Kings learned it the hard way. And I think the Predators would too, that the Sharks are just not going to let a team survive that, you know, James Neal's around the ice, basically. That's going to be a problem for Nashville.
I think if the Sharks avoid any cheap shots from Neal, they're probably fine. But
That's what I was going to say. The two biggest fears are Pecorine and James Neal killing Marc-Edouard Vlasic. That's basically the two biggest fears heading into the series, because that seems like something that could happen.
Poor pickles. The one thing that sort of piqued my interest, and Nick and Derek talked a little bit earlier about the Sharks King series, so we won't rehash that too much, and I'm not just saying that because I don't want to talk about it. But the one thing that surprised me in Game 5 was the performance of the depth players for San Jose. After four games of talking about how San Jose was a one-line team, they got two goals from Donskoy. They got a goal from, I think, Chris Tierney, maybe. I don't remember if that was an empty netter. But the bottom nine guys showed up. Do you think that is that going to be a continuing theme next round? Are we going to be looking at that second line again and wondering why they're not producing? Or are the contributions going to be more well-rounded?
Yeah, I think the contributions will be more well-rounded. I mean, the reason that the Sharks were a one-line team against the Kings is because the Kings are really, 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 really good. I mean, you know, I think people, you know, not you, obviously, but I know a lot of people, like, pretend that the other team doesn't exist. You know, the Kings are really good at hockey. I mean, I newsflash. They were neutralized for the most part. You know, I know, yeah, whatever. In one game, a lot of crazy, crazy stuff can happen.
Back, by the way. We asked you back to talk about how the Kings are really good.
I have a lot of respect for what the Kings have been able to do. I have a lot of respect for the, you know, the coaching staff and most of the, when Dean Lombardi isn't talking, generally his stuff. I think that playing against the Kings and that kind of a series is a cool thing because they're two really good teams that kind of get what they're doing. You know, it's a totally different thing than, you know, a team like Anaheim, which I just absolutely despise because they're just crappy in every sense of the word. They're awful and awful to play against, and you know, their stars aren't likable. Like, there's no Tyler Toffoli or Andre Kopitar on the Ducks. They just don't exist. You know, it's just not there. I mean, Corey Perry makes Milan Lucic look like a pretty likable guy, which is, I mean, I feel like that's, you know, there you go. But yeah,
I've been on the record as not being a Ducks hater at all, and my brother is a Ducks fan. I'm rooting for them tonight. I'll root for them in a fair amount of neutral matchups because I like, you know, I like SoCal teams doing well. And I mean, Corey Perry is my least favorite player in hockey, regardless of my feelings for any of the other Ducks. I just, you know, I have a lot of built-in hate for him, and he's not the objectively most hateable person in the NHL, but I just can't stand them.
Pretty cool.
But in regards to the other team, like, or the other guys in the team, the ones who are you know, their veterans all carry that sort of reputation, right? So if you look at your, you know, Rickard Rakell or your Hampus Lindholm or your Frederick Anderson and John Gibson, they're all on the outset are unlikable enough, but they haven't built up enough of, you know, the type of Kopitar or Burns reputation where you're like, okay, you know what, I can really support that guy. You got to see a few more years of them and get to know them a little better, and then maybe at that point you can say, well, I don't like these guys, but there's a reason I can root for this team.
Right. To me, one of the biggest things is, like, you know, as much as I'm not like a big, you know, handshake line guy or whatever, that's not all that important to me. Like, watching it after that, you know, and this has been true for all the Sharks King series, like the way that Joe Thornton, you know, like, greets Anze Kopitar is totally different than any of the other players on the Kings. And to me, that says something. You know, that's a guy that he has a lot of respect for because, I mean, it's Anze Kopitar. And I know that the rest of the world maybe isn't aware of this, but at least us in California are pretty aware that he's not just a great hockey player. He's just, you know, he's good people. That is a guy that is really, really easy to root for. And the Ducks just don't have a veteran guy like that, you know, that is, I mean, listen, they've got Corey Perry, Ryan Getzlaf, and Ryan Kessler. That was like, good Lord, you know, the Ducks can't get more unlikable than they sign or get him. And it's just, there it is. That was impressive. I was impressed by that.
Right. And I would want to go back and rewatch the handshakes from Kings Ducks 2014, because I feel like there's a lot of mutual respect, and, you know, Perry and Dowdy are apparently friends, and I'm sure there are plenty of bonds there, but NBC sort of spent the entire handshake line filming Teemu Selänne, which makes sense. It was his final game in the NHL, and you were getting much better TV from the Kings basically dropping their, hey, we think we're the best team in the league guard, and telling Teemu how much he meant to them. But I would be interested to go back and see how those, you know, how much mutual respect there was, because I think there's more hate now than there was 2 years ago, but I think there's also maybe something to the fact that Kopitar hasn't built up that sort of mutual respect, not so much animosity, with the other Ducks players.
Right. Yeah. I honestly think it's kind of interesting because I know people talk about the Sharks and Kings, that's like the big rivalry. And it's tough for me because I hate the Ducks so much and I don't really have that towards the Kings. I mean, thinking about it, you know, obviously the Kings have the cups, that's great. But, you know, if you look at the playoff series, you know, it's 2-2, and three of those series have been, really all of them have been very close. Even the ones the Sharks won, you know, I know neither of those are seven gamers or anything, but, you know, still close series.
Yeah.
So I think that to me, it's like, it's kind of a different thing. You know, I don't know, but who's to say?
Right. So Anaheim and LA out, San Jose against Nashville in one series. Across the rest of the league, I think Tampa versus the Islanders is a bit of a toss-up. I was happy to see Detroit get knocked out, so I wasn't too disappointed with the way that turned out. But I think Capitals, Pens, and Blues Stars is about as good as you're going to get from a neutral standpoint. Unless you really wanted to see Chicago again, maybe objectively that Blackhawks Stars series is more wild, but I think we got some pretty good matchups.
Yeah, Stars Blues is going to be a lot of fun. There are going to be a lot of goals in that series.
Mm-hmm. And even with the Blues sort of Hitchcockian reputation, you still get to watch Vladimir Tarasenko.
Right, who is just
for
the greatest.
15 minutes or so.
Right. Oh, God. Well, fair. Yeah, I think Vladimir Tarasenko is pretty close to one of my favorite non-Sharks players in the NHL to watch, just from a neutral standpoint. It's just, he's just so great. It's just everything he does.
Yeah.
Penn will also be good. We'll get some more of that manufactured Ovechkin-Crosby rivalry that we've all grown so fond of over the years. Can't wait for that.
That one kicks off tomorrow, I imagine.
It does, yes, at 5 o'clock. I actually work with a Penguins fan, so that'll be on the old office TV, so looking forward to it.
Good. I think favorites, I mean, probably the Sharks are, I think the Sharks are probably the strongest favorite in any of those four series. And I say that because I don't think the Islanders and the Lightning, anybody has made enough judgments about that. Maybe the Lightning are slight favorites, but with Stamkos, I think they'd be much stronger. And then Pens and Capitals, it's all on who you talk to. And I think it's going seven, and I hope it's going seven, because the 2009 series, as overblown as it was, as much as they sort of built up a rivalry that didn't really exist at the time, it still ended up being a terrific series.
Yeah, because they both play really fun, good, fun to watch hockey. That's the thing. To me, it's like from a neutral standpoint, it's not about, Crosby and Ovechkin. I mean, it's about, just these are two very talented, fast, offensive teams, and I like watching them play.
Yeah.
So.
So I'll make you go on the record again. Eastern Conference, who do you think makes it out?
Yeah, I have Penguins. My cup pick was Penguins over Kings. So obviously that whole Kings thing didn't work out so hot, but I'll stick with the Penguins.
Okay.
Ride or die.
Yeah, and I've got three of my final four left. The fourth, obviously, being the Kings, because I haven't learned how to separate my rooting interests from my gut feelings yet. Or maybe it's just that my gut feelings go with my rooting interests. But
it's like a symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, exactly. And I had the Blues and the Caps and the Lightning, and I thought the Caps were going to make it. And again, that's a gut feeling and a rooting interest. So we'll hope that works out. And
yeah,
I found it interesting that, the person who we go to the most, at least on our site, for those sort of mathematical projections is Micah Blake-McCurdy, and he picks the Capitals despite the Capitals not having that edge in a lot of his models. With, I think the Penguins are a solid favorite in most of his predictions, but he picked the Caps. So make of it what you will.
Goddamn nerds just can't keep their stuff straight. That's ridiculous.
Hey, you know what? I respect the ability to sort of separate the gut feelings there, even if gut feelings are dangerous.
Well, I have a lot in common with Patrick Marleau. Great eyebrows and both gutless, so I go straightly by the numbers.
I
try to
separate
it as
much
as possible.
Year, but
you well,
tried your best.
It's still, I always give 110% everything I do. To me, I think that really this is the Sharks year, to win or lose. They, if they play the way that they can, they really should, at the very least, get to their first Stanley Cup final. If that happens, I don't know. Who knows? I feel good. For the first time in, good Lord, many years, I'm excited about this next playoff series. So that's a relief. That's kind of nice. What a fun new feeling for me.
Yeah, this can only end well for you. I'm with you, man. I'm with you. So on that note, we'll stop talking about the Sharks for a minute. The best moment of the early podcast today was me getting to break the news to Nick and Derek on the air that Jonathan Quick had been nominated for the Vezina Trophy. Individual awards race is now sort of in full steam, and we're going to get more Quick stats-related tweets knocking him down than we've ever gotten before, which I didn't think was possible. We're going to look forward to it. But the rest of the nominations are coming up this week. Do you see any Sharks getting nods? And we talked last time about Burns' Norris chances and Thornton's Selke chances. And unfortunately for Joe especially, voting has been done for a while. Do you think any Sharks get some recognition there?
I really do think that Joe has a shot at getting a Selke nomination. And honestly, I think that's probably it. yeah, Marlowe is always a favorite for the Lady Bing nomination. He likes to go there and lose to somebody else. That's definitely been a thing in the past. I really just don't see them getting nominated for anything. I really don't think Burns has a great shot at the Norris, which is, you know, something I've said previously. I really think that will be Erik Karlsson and Dowdy and, I don't know, some third guy who won't win. Right. But, yeah, I don't know. Really, the Jonathan Quick thing did legitimately surprise me, and I'm not, you know, trying to be a dick about it or whatever, but it's just like that was actually pretty surprising. So I'm only saying that because, well, who knows? Listen, I've been surprised once, and we've only got one nomination, so who's to say? Clearly, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about, which lines up with what – right, exactly, which goes without saying, fair enough. But yeah, I think Thornton for the Selke is probably the best shot we're going to get at a Sharks nom. Mm-hmm.
And I think the best argument I saw sort of in favor of Quick was from Thomas Drance, who basically laid out the fact that at this point, Jonathan Quick is so there's so many people talking about how overrated Jonathan Quick is that he might be underrated at this point, which maybe isn't a reason for nominating him for a trophy, but the sort of other crux of that argument was that Quick's workload and his team's success in some sort of combination can make an argument that if he's not the best goalie, he at least deserves a nomination. I don't know how much stock I put into, you know, the way you combine those is by saying Quick played 68 games this year for a team that had the third best even strength save percentage in the league, or that over the past however many seasons, the Kings have been one of the best goaltending teams and he's played the bulk of their starts. It's a question of how much you put into the fact that Jones had an outlandishly good backup season in his rookie year, and Enroth put up really good numbers in his limited action.
Sure did.
This year. So it's sort of hard to reconcile when everything you can really know about a goalie comes from his save percentage, and that's the only way you can sort of normalize it across teams. But Quick gets credit this year for his team, and it was interesting seeing the argument framed in a way other than Quick's team carried him to this. So I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I thought it was interesting.
I think it's I think it's unfair to say that the Kings carried Quick to an okay save percentage. I think that's silly. I know it's hard to separate one from the other, but to me, it's one of those things where I've always said I think Quick is a very fine. He's fine, a fine goalie. You know, you can do a whole lot worse, and God knows every team in Canada has tried. At the same time, he just has never, to me, in the regular season, shown something that would make him worthy of winning this award, which I know a lot of people take as, like, you know, a knock on Quick. And to me, no, it's not. A goalie does not have to be Henrik Lundqvist to be good. Quick is good and has been incredible in the playoffs, obviously, which, you know, if we're being honest, that's all anyone cares about anyway, right? So whatever. I don't really see a good argument for him being nominated for the Vezina based on this season in particular. I mean, I don't even think this is his best season. I don't know. At the end of the day, he's not going to win it anyway, and neither was whoever the other third guy was going to be. It's going to be either Holtby or whoever Bishop. The other guy was. Like, right, Bishop. Right. Probably should be Bishop. Probably will be Holtby. That's kind of how I feel about it.
Yeah, and Quick's had one really tremendous season, and he got a Vezina nomination that year, too. So it's not like, again, it's the same argument as with Doughty, where he hasn't really been overlooked. It's just that it's come around to the point where the number of slam dunk contenders shrunk, and, you know, maybe you're going to get a reputation nomination in there. It happened.
Right. It's not that big.
Yeah, and it'll be, it's going to be fun from our perspective to most likely have nominations in all the major award categories in a year where the Kings won one playoff game. But it's overdue, so I'm not going to complain about it at all. And if the Sharks manage to go on to great playoff success this year and get a bunch of nominations in 2018 when they aren't as good, then you know what? They probably deserve it too.
Right. I think a good rule of thumb is never put too much stock into award nominations. Don't take them that seriously, and your life will be a whole lot better.
I'll allow it. So that's the awards. We got 20 minutes left. I think the other things that I mentioned we were going to talk about we talked about Sharks depth. So the main thing that I had brought up was the Kings defense, and we'll tie it into the Sharks defense too, so I'm not just talking for the next 15 minutes about myself. But the Nashville-Anaheim game today, they were talking about how Nashville's top four, which is Weber, Roman Josi, and then Ryan Ellis, and I think Ekholm is the fourth guy, about how they sort of go up against anybody in the league. And we saw what happened when the Kings sort of lost one of their top four. We've seen what happened when the Sharks lost one of their top four. So we talked about Burns a lot. We've talked about Doughty a lot. The rest of that top four, beyond Burns and Vlasic, it's Paul Martin and Justin Braun, who don't get the press that the other two guys get. And Martin maybe did when he was in Pittsburgh, but Justin Braun, I think, to a lot of people, is sort of an unknown quantity. So I'll give you a minute to pump their tires.
Well, Justin Braun gets to play with Mark Edward Vlasic, which is really nice for him. Sharks fans do not like Justin Braun very much. Not as much as they dislike Brendan Dillon, but he is not a fan favorite by any means. I think he is fine. He is good. The reason that he has put up good numbers is because he gets to play with Mark Edward Vlasic. I think, to be honest, that the fact that Vlasic's numbers have been so good for so long, and you know, so good this season, even with Braun, speak to how good Vlasic is as opposed to how good Braun is. I know that's not a great ringing endorsement for Justin Braun, but he's fine. He's good enough, but he's not. There's really, like, I would not feel good about I don't even know if I could lie and pump his tires well enough for it to be worth anything. There's a reason people don't talk about him. It's because he's, you know, not that great. He's fine.
Interesting. Adequate. Interesting. Okay, because, yeah, I mean, when I was – writing various previews and whatnot, I was struck by how in a lot of cases his numbers were really well, you know, he looked really good. And with Jake Muzzin, it was always a question of, is it because he plays with Drew Doughty? And turns out it wasn't, but you also still get a lot of people questioning his ability because he doesn't get to play with Drew Doughty and he makes mistakes and
sure.
He thrusts into a higher role. So it's interesting to hear that Braun's, at least from the mind's eye, is sort of a relying on Vlasic thing. But what about Martin?
Paul Martin is incredible. That he is legitimately underrated. That's a guy I feel pretty good about pumping the tires for. And the thing is, it's not – I know that the way we like to view defensemen is kind of like, oh, this guy's an anchor and this guy, you know, carries him, right? I don't really think that it's that simple. I think it's more like – if you look at the way that certain guys play, certain styles of play blend together better than others. And I think that really, like, the Brent Burns and Paul Martin are just really a perfect pairing together. And it's really everything that I thought it was going to be when the Sharks signed him. You know, Paul Martin played a lot with Chris Letang, who, a lot like Burns, gets a whole lot more press for his offense than his defense. And it's just the way that Burns especially has kind of adapted to the way Martin has played. It's been, you know, it's been a lot of fun to see. And the kind of plays that Paul Martin makes are not the kind that are going to get him a Norris nominations, right? But you see guys who try to, you know, make moves against him to try to gain the blue line or whatever. And he's just so calm in those situations where he's able to, you know, I've seen him make plays where, you know, got really, really skilled players. You know, I think I actually saw Kopitar try to do this, where he tries to gain the blue line on Martin, by kind of poking the puck past him and then, you know, skating by him. And Martin is able to, in one motion, check Kopitar into the wall, turn around, gain possession of the puck, and pass it out of the over the blue line. And that's like, you know, the, watching that is, you know, incredible that he's able to do that so calmly against a guy that is, you know, one of the scariest in the NHL. So, yeah, that is a guy that I think is really underrated, you know, where Brent Burns gets all the press because, I mean, look at him, right? Paul Martin is a big part of the reason that we get to talk about Brent Burns so much, for me anyway. And I know Penguins fans miss him dearly because every time I write about Paul Martin, the posts go just absolutely crazy numbers because of people in Pittsburgh. They also love him in Minnesota. He's a University of Minnesota alum, and good Lord, I've gotten lots of emails from people who ask for more Paul Martin stuff that are definitely Gopher fans.
Fascinating. And Martin's 35. He signed through 2019, so I'm sure
that contract's gonna suck at the end.
Sure, but I mean that's what we looked at, like Willie Mitchell, who was playing in that kind of form at least until maybe not the final year of his contract with the Kings, but close to it. And he gets a contract from Florida, which is sort of, we want you to be really good for the next year or two. And Martin is making, I guess, you know, from your observations, he's making the kind of difference that'll make it worth it, even if his 2018-19 isn't so good.
Right. The Sharks need to win either now or next year, which I know we've talked about before. So I'm not really worried about 2018 or 19 or whatever. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Right. And that was my obligatory Willie Mitchell mention for the podcast. Hang in there, Willie. He's still one of our favorites. So hopefully his health gets better. In regards to the Kings defense, again, that top four, we're still at the point where the Kings have a top three, and that fourth spot is up for grabs. And Braden McNabb has been the guy this year who, honestly, I think you could ask any Kings fan what their impression of McNabb this year, and it would be hard for them to say a whole lot more than, he was okay, because he didn't really up and seize the spot. Like, he makes big hits fairly often, and that's what most people will take away from a normal game of his. Like, I think in game five, in fact, it was like on the same shift the Sharks scored their second or third goal, McNabb made two huge hits, and it looked like they were going to turn things around until they didn't. But the top four, and Chicago showed it last year, you don't need a six good defenseman to win a cup. You just need four guys, two pairings that you can really, really rely on. So the Kings have about five fringe guys past those top four and a fourth guy who maybe doesn't fit in there. And, you know, you see it with San Jose where you can put Braun out there with Vlasic, and you know, with the Kings, you can put McNabb out there with Doughty. But the cap is squeezing for the Kings in this offseason, and there's talk about which defenseman they want to keep. And do you just, if you're running an NHL team, do you just go as cheap as possible with your fifth and sixth defenseman and really invest in that top four guy?
That's tough. I think, yes, probably, if your defense is as good as the Kings' top four is.
I mean, the Kings are that everyone faces, though.
Right.
The
Kings are kind of getting to that point where they're going to start kind of, you know, I know we've talked about it before, where they're going to start paying for the fact that, you know, they gave really big contracts to guys to win now and basically lose later. And I think that we're kind of at least getting to that time. So if I'm the Kings, I double down on the, you know, on the stars or whatever. I know that's a big thing in hockey, this idea that, you know, you can't have too much cap space tied up into, you know, two players, and the Taze Kane thing, the Crosby Malkin thing. And to me, it's like, nah, invest your money in stars and then, you know, trust Dean Lombardi to be smart enough to try to make it work with, you know, either younger guys or cheap veteran guys in the 5-6 role. That's my preference personally. But I don't know. Your mileage may vary.
Yeah, I think it kind of has to. What's the Sharks' draft situation this year? Do you know how many picks they have off the top of your head?
I do. They have six. They do not have a first or a third, but they have 2 fourth-rounders. They got a fourth-rounder from New York last year for James Shepard, I believe. So this year is not all that interesting, to be quite honest, for the Sharks, unless something, you know, wild happens. Patrick Marleau rumors have not gone away, so I guess it kind of depends on what happens this year, but I would not be absolutely floored if he gets moved during the offseason, which could change the pick situation, so we'll see.
And it was so fascinating last year for the first time I would have preferred not to have to do this, but covering the Kings from a perspective of, wow, they actually have a pick in the top half of the first round, what might they do with it? And granted, we spent a month writing articles about various prospects and talking about whether they should go for a forward or a defenseman, and what do? They trade the 13th pick away. So I can't say that we really got to cash in all the draft excitement, but this year the Kings have 4 picks, and they only have 4 because they didn't make it out of the first round. Otherwise, they would have had only 3 because one of them was conditional. So all we're going to really be able to get hyped about is free agency and the unrestricted guys who may or may not be coming back. So hopefully the awards give us something else to think about, because the draft's going to be a bit of a snooze.
Yeah, well, it's a good problem to have, in my opinion. I'm perfect, you know, my girlfriend is a Leafs fan, and, you know, she talks about the draft and prospects a lot, and it's like, wow, I am not jealous of that situation in any sense of the word. That's fine, you know, you have fun with the draft. I'll continue to not care about the draft all that much, and that's been a pretty great existence for me so far.
Sure, and we, you know, we got our few years of top picks and getting a bunch of people enraged about Thomas Hickey going number 4, and now he's an overtime hero in New York, so good for that guy. But I agree. I think this is a good place to be. It might suck for the Kings in a couple of years, but at least we're still looking at another year or two of being a legit contender. And if the Ducks get rid of Bruce Boudreau and decide they want to trade some of the top end guys, then the division race is going to be really interesting next year.
Yeah, agreed. Especially as, you know, things are going to get even tighter for Chicago next year. So it's going to be kind of an interesting few years for the Western Conference, I think. It's going to be interesting to see how people try to get around the cap situation.
Right, and Chicago finds a way around it every couple of years. They manage to sort of retool. Yeah. And I don't know if that's in the cards for LA, but I also don't know if it's in the cards for Chicago at this point, because they've got a hilarious Brent Seabrook contract to go along with Dave McCain taking up like a quarter of their cap. So who knows? It's wide open, and that was the feel that a lot of people had after Nashville beat Anaheim, was interesting. We've got 3 teams that have never won a cup and one that hasn't won a cup in, you know, 17, 18 years. Now is your final four in the West. So it's people knock parity all the time, but from the perspective of a team that benefited from that kind of parity, it's kind of fun from a neutral standpoint.
Yeah, I think it's 4 teams, right, in the playoffs right now that in the final 8 that have never won a cup, I think, right? Because Sharks, Predators,
yeah,
Blues, and Capitals, right? And that's
right,
pretty incredible.
Right. And I think the Penguins are the only one that's won a cup since
right?
the lockout. Because, the Lightning, I think, were the year before the lockout. So
right, 2003 or whatever it was.
Or something, yeah.
Or 4.
I always 4. Forget whether Carolina was before and Tampa was after, the other way around.
No,
I think Tampa
was
before.
Yeah, Carolina is after. They're the Stanley Cup champion that the time forgot. That was the 05-06er.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it should be a fun playoff, even if most of the people listening to this are going to swear off hockey for a while. Overtime will suck us back in.
Yeah, trust me, I know how they feel. Yeah, there have definitely been plenty of years where it's been like, well, maybe I'll just watch baseball for the next few months.
And it just never works like that, does it?
It does not. It does not. Never has, never will.
Yeah, well, hopefully we get some Game 7 overtime in this round. I don't know, have the Sharks ever played a Game 7 overtime game?
Not that I can remember, which doesn't mean that it hasn't happened, but I'm fairly confident when I say no, they have not. I'm going to say no.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily wish it upon you, but it's a feeling unlike any other.
I certainly don't wish it upon myself. That is a fact.
Yeah. But from a neutral standpoint, I hope every Game 7 goes to 4 overtimes and I can sit on the West Coast and only have to stay up until midnight or so.
The worst.
Yeah, it's awful. So we'll wind it down. We got less than 3 minutes to go. So I think I'm pretty much out of stuff. Any final thoughts you have on the first round?
No, I thought that I was very pleasantly surprised by how well the Sharks played against the Kings. And I have gotten a – good Lord, if it makes you feel any better, I have just gotten absolutely just destroyed in my email and Twitter mentions by people coming to get me for not picking the Sharks. So I am not a true believer, which is probably the most accurate thing that's ever been said about me.
It makes it all the better when they come through. If you didn't just know in your heart that it was going to happen, then it's fun. So thanks again for coming on for a second time. Hopefully your mentions survive the horribly unsupportive things you've said about the Sharks' minor faults. And I hope it was worth it.
It's always worth it. Always, always a pleasure.
All right. Thanks again. Thanks again to everyone for listening. We'll be back probably next week. The Ontario Reign and the San Jose Barracuda, who we neglected to talk about today, are still in the middle of their first round series. So, and the Reign are great, and I think we can that's all we really need to say about it. But again, for the Kings fans out there, we'll be back next week talking about the AHL and about their playoff series, which will wrap up. They play tomorrow, Friday, and if necessary, Sunday. For now, thanks again for listening. This has been the JewelCast.